Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is John Kreischer, Professor Emeritus of Biology at Wheaton College, an internationally recognized ecologist, ornithologist, and author. And we're talking about his new book, Galapagos, A Natural History. John, welcome back to the show. It is always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be back. I keep writing books so I can be on your show.
And I keep thinking he can't get any better at this. And you do. This new book is what I would call like the perfect guide. You know, it covers all the bases well. Even if you've never gone to the Galapagos, even if you don't plan on going, you should read the book. If you do go, it's a must-have to bring with you. And it's just about the right size, the pack. Kudos to you, man. good job.
Well, thanks, Mark. It was a good collaboration. I had written a book about the Galapagos some time ago. I think 2006 is when it was first published. It was fine at the time, I guess. What I wanted to do about the Galapagos is what was lacking at the time, in my estimation. There were relatively few books that actually delved into the natural history right. of the organisms of the Galapagos. There were more and more quickie guides so that you would know what a giant tortoise looks like you really need to. It's the big thing that looks like a rock walking on those big seven. I wanted a thorough natural history. Now, the other thing I wanted was that the Galapagos, like two coils of a DNA molecule, the Galapagos and Charles Darwin are wrapped around yeah. one another. And nobody had done Darwin justice, in my estimation, about his work on the Galapagos, except in the scholarly literature, where it was really well understood what the significance of the Galapagos was to Darwin and how it came to be that way, and how he followed a fairly torturous trail in order to get where he got. So we could talk about that if you want, but I really wanted to do justice to the animals, the plants, and when Kevin Lachlan came along, I marginally knew him. I've met him a couple of times. And it was a funny story. We were at Pico Bonito Lodge down in Honduras, and I was admiring these big photographs of the various Pico Bonito birds, like the motmots and the trogons and hummingbirds. And a guy came up behind me, and I turned around. He's got a big grin on his face, and he said, "You're John Kreischer." And I said, "Yeah, I know you. We've met." He said, "I'm Kevin Lachlan." And he said, "I took those pictures." And so the conversation unfolded quickly, and Kevin said, "I really like your Galapagos book, but you must know that it needs revision." And I said, "Yeah, I'm very well aware of that. The taxonomic changes have been quite dramatic in terms of the past two decades since I wrote that book." And he said, "How'd you like to do it and have me do all of the photographic illustrations?"
And so you actually had to think it over, right?
it gets funny. I said, "Well, that sounds like a really good idea. I don't mind revising it. I'd actually welcome that."
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'll have to run it by my editor, Robert Kirk at Princeton University Press. And he said, "Oh, I know Robert. I've already talked to him about it. He's all for it."
I was going to say, this has to have been the quickest done deal in the world.
It really is. I was the last one to know.
Well, let's talk about some basics for people who have never been. One of the things that I love is that you mentioned the Wonders of Life on Earth, the Life magazine issue, and later a book that had a tremendous influence on me too. We're both about the same age, I'm sure. And why that book must have turned out hundreds of ecologists and biologists.
I can only hope so. I tip my hat very much to Life magazine for their courageous portrayal of evolution in the early 1950s when they had iconic cover of the Yale Brontosaurus on the cover of Life. I think that was 53 or something like that, 1953. But then they came out with The World We Live In and then The Wonders of Life on Earth. And my parents were quick to get me those books. Parents out there, get your kids books. When you
seriously
see them, get them books. And I connected with the mostly with the artwork initially, but then when I started reading the various accounts, I was, you know, it really put me on the pathway to becoming an ecologist.
Now, putting this guide together must have been tough because there are so many bases to cover. There's the obvious connection with Darwin, you know, hat and glove, but you also cover things like the geological history, the ecology, all sorts of other things, and then the seas around the Galapagos. What was your baseline for the information that was needed to be contained in this book? It's not just about Darwin; it's about everything.
Yes, I made an outline to myself a long time ago as to what absolutely needed to be included in order to, you know, properly present the topic. And I was lucky enough to have gone to the Galapagos in the mid-1980s, well before I had thought about doing this book and well before, obviously, I'd done it. And then I went back again in the 1990s. So I had a good bit of Galapagos experience to draw upon, and I had visual images of much of what the Galapagos were like. And then the early 2000s, not long after I published the first version of the book, I went again. And then in 2019, I started the revision, Kevin Lachlan and I co-led a tour there. So I had it's right what you know. And I needed experience on the islands. And I like to think of myself as a relatively quick study, so that when I can go to a place, I take in a lot of information. I make copious notes, and I keep detailed trip logs. Yep. And so I had that basis to draw upon when I started writing the book. And Darwin was not exactly an afterthought. It was a primary thing. And I even titled the chapters in the book after passages in The Voyage of the Beagle, written by Darwin. For instance, the chapter on Darwin is called Eminently Curious, which is how he described the fauna of the Galapagos. Eminently curious.
What a strange
combination of animals. So I had that to draw on.
For people who have never even heard the term before, let's just give out the very basics of what the Galapagos are.
The very basics of the Galapagos are this. The Galapagos is an archipelago. That is absolutely critical to understanding its evolution. It's a series of relatively small but a few large islands that have never been attached to the mainland, that have arisen from a hot spot in the Pacific Ocean and that continue to do so, that are about the oldest, most western Galapagos island is about, not western, but eastern, is about 8 million years old. That's Hispaniola, to the east. And then to the west in the archipelago are the youngest islands. So they continue to come up from the interior of the Earth over time. And because it's an archipelago, organisms that get there can be isolated from one another and thus evolve in different ways. The other thing that's important about it being an archipelago is that there's no way anything can get there unless it comes from someplace else.
And, of course, you cannot say Galapagos without mentioning Darwin. September 17th, 1835. Mm-hmm. And it would lead to his writing the book, and this is a quote from this book, that would change biology and Western philosophy.
Oh, sure.
And I know that. know that. But it is incredible to have an actual physical location you can go and go, this is what really stirred him. And started him on that route.
I doubt it would have happened without the Galapagos. Darwin was a homebody. His intention was to quietly, he was independently wealthy, thanks to his family. His intention was to become a kind of country parson. It wasn't that he was strongly religious at the time. It was just what gentlemen did when they wanted to have idle time on their hands so that they could go out and catch beetles. And that was how I think he saw his life, riding horses, catching beetles, playing with his dog, and having a successful family. Well, he was able to do all of that. But when he got to the Galapagos, that was an extremely important moment for human history, biology, philosophy, et cetera. Not everybody could have done what he did. You could go to the Galapagos and not see much at all in terms of intellectual stimulation. But he was a young man. I often tell my students, I'm retired now, that the time in your life when you're most apt to be a genius is when you're in your 20s and 30s. By the time you get into your 40s and 50s, if you've played it well in your 20s and 30s, you start to draw on collective wisdom and start to put ideas together at that point. So it all works if you do it right. Darwin was very, very eminently curious himself. And when he did that whole voyage of the Beagle, he never lost a chance to think about what he was seeing, even though he fought seasickness and he had a neurotic captain of the Beagle and named Robert Fitzroy. That's another story. And so Darwin was an extraordinary man. And one of the great affronts to my education was when I was in high school and was told that Darwin was one of many people who thought that maybe something like evolution occurred. He was very good correspondent, and he wrote to a lot of people, and then he put together from what they wrote to him this long book called The Origin of Species. That is just such a mischaracterization of this genius who was able to put all this together. So I was absolutely thrilled the first time I was on the Galapagos Islands. The first Darwin's finch I saw was an emotional moment.
It would be for me, too. And let's explain Darwin's finches and why they're so important in the history of evolution.
Yeah, Darwin's finches and Darwin's mockingbird.
Right.
That's a curious story, too. But the Darwin's finches, which represent the great iconic example of adaptive radiation and evolution, represent the two characteristics that Darwin brought to science and the understanding of the history of life on Earth. One of them was the tree of life, that all forms of life, because of their genetic commonalities, are related, just to various degrees, and that you can trace the history of life back through time, and it's a very divergent, very complex branching pattern. And so the concept that you share genes in common with a camel and that you share genes in common with, say, a fungus or a tree, that's all quite literally true. It just is a matter of how far back you go. So the tree of life was Darwin's image of how evolution worked. He didn't see independent creations of each form of life, independent gene pools. So that deals with the concept of Darwin versus creationism. The other characteristic Darwin perceived was natural selection. Now, again, it takes a village, and there were people in Great Britain at the time that were doing selective experiments to grow trees better. And Darwin was a voracious reader, and he was well aware that it was possible to select for various characteristics. He raised pigeons, for instance, and actually watched their genetic patterns, although he wasn't a mathematician sufficiently talented to figure out Mendel's laws, even though they were revealed in some of his experiments. So Darwin was very, very curious and discovered this thing called natural selection, which is really, really critical to understanding his contribution to evolution. All prior evolutionists, and there weren't very many, and they included his own grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, but the one most people think about is Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, the French evolutionary biologist who argued for the inheritance of acquired characteristics. All of them had divine intervention. Or something like it in the creation of organisms. Darwin didn't require that, and it doesn't require that at all. You can understand the evolutionary pattern without having to relate to the three-word sentence, God did it.
The amazing thing about everything you're saying is that, you know, people are tuning in and listening and thinking we're having like this sort of intellectual talk here. You can go to the Galapagos and see all of what we're talking about in action.
Yep, you really can.
Look at all the different finches that, and all the different size bills and the different patterns of these finches. It's all right there for you to look at.
Yeah, I gave a long-winded answer to the fact that you ask about the finches and what you see when you go from island to island.
It's right there in your face.
Are finches here, there, and everywhere. And if you're, you'll start in the lowlands and you'll see the ground finches and cactus finches. And then you'll get up into the highlands and you'll start to see the tree finches. If you're lucky, you'll see the, and you probably will be, you'll see the woodpecker finch. If you see this odd finch that has a bill like a parrot, that's the vegetarian finch, which gets into the thick trees. It becomes blatantly apparent that these things are related to one another. They all make a similar kind of nest. They all follow a very similar pattern of when they're hatched out, their beaks are yellow and they turn gradually to black. It just is staring you in the face. It is so dramatic that Darwin didn't even realize they were all finches. He collected, did his Captain Fitzroy collect finches, and he mistook the warbler finch. He didn't think it was a finch because it had a very sharp beak on it. He thought it was some kind of a wren or something like that. And he mistook the common cactus finch, which has a beak very much like a blackbird, not like a finch. It's elongated. So it required the help of another person, John Gould, the premier ornithologist in Britain, to show Darwin that they were all finches. When Gould left from his meeting with, when Darwin left from his meeting with Gould, he had become an evolutionist. He didn't become an evolutionist on the Galapagos, but he did when he sorted it out when he got back home, soon after he got back home.
Now, you don't have to go to the Galapagos and come up with the idea of evolution, because Louis Agassiz's visit to the islands in 1872 proves that.
Well, there's two examples of people who are considered deeply intellectual, which got an F on their Agassiz was certainly one of them. Agassiz was, I don't want to go into discussing details of Louis Agassiz, but Stephen Jay Gould, showed that Agassiz was just a terrible racist. Even though he did not favor slavery, he was anti-slavery, but he was that. But beyond that, Agassiz was deeply religious, and he just wouldn't be talked out of it by nobody, including Darwin. And so when he went to the Galapagos and looked around, and he was old, and I don't think he was very healthy, he simply is recorded as saying to the effect, well, there's nothing about it that jumps out at me as far as evolution is concerned. And that is, of course, in the context of the fact that Darwin had already been there. And the other person whose name will be recognized who failed on the Galapagos test was Herman Melville.
Amazing.
Yeah, Moby Dick's father went out there in order to research Moby Dick. Melville's real stimulation was the fact that a whale sunk the whale ship Essex, and that's a very grim story. But Melville went out to the Galapagos and looked around, and he thought the penguins were grotesque, that everything was just an aberration of nature. He was really he didn't get any of it.
Well, yeah, and that's when I read that in your book, I was just like, first of all, Galapagos is probably the one place you absolutely have to bring a camera, because it's not only, we've been talking birds, but there's giant tortoises, there's flightless cormorants, there's pinnipeds, there's seals, there's and it's all just happening in front of you. The mockingbirds are famous, if you're trying to photograph them, for them walking up and standing on your camera. It's just an amazing place for photography. So to read that Herman Melville just sort of like went there and went, it was just the essential thing of no big deal.
Well, the other person who did the same thing was the great British ornithologist. This is 20th century, David Lack.
Yes. Wow.
Lack's first visit to the Galapagos depressed him to no end. He really did not like it there. He didn't, he wasn't living in a comfortable accommodation. And the Galapagos, if you're there by yourself and you're there, for a long time, I guess can be intimidating. It wasn't intimidating to me, and it's not intimidating to the 250,000 people who go there every year. But and nonetheless, he was another one who said, I don't know, it's not very nice, but he went back a second time, and that's when the light shone upon his brain for the finches, and that's when he wrote that wonderful book called Darwin's Finches, and he pretty much figured it out. Darwin's Finches were called that by somebody prior to David Lack, but he popularized the name.
Now, we're going to run out of time. And we haven't talked specifically about anything. But what are the, first of all, there are these giant tortoises, several species across the islands. And you mentioned in this book, and this never occurred to me, is it possible that a tortoise that is alive today was alive during Darwin's visit?
It's getting very much less possible each day, because that would have to be a fairly Methuselan tortoise. But I remember a cartoon I saw a long time ago of two Galapagos tortoises. One says to the other, yeah, I remember Darwin. Nice guy. I think it's probably not likely. After all, it was 1835 when he was there.
You never know.
It would have to be really close to 200 years old now, and they don't have that kind of longevity, I don't think. So, but
I have to tell you that the tortoises alone, to be in the presence of a huge, ponderous reptile like that, is just phenomenal. And you do see them. It's not like you have a chance to see them.
That's the nice thing. When I first went there in the 1980s, you saw them very well at the Darwin Research Station, which is had them on display, but you didn't see them in the wild. And then it was discovered that the farmers of Santa Cruz Island, and that's the island where Darwin Research Station is, routinely had these tortoises in their farming areas and just left them alone. And so it became possible to initiate a tourist industry where the farmers allow people to come and walk around and see their tortoises. And then the farmers also dig pools for the tortoises.
Yeah,
they like to water.
Yeah.
And these are the dome-shelled tortoises, the ones that are the highlands tortoises. The ones from the lowlands, which are the saddle-shelled tortoises, there's no place on the Galapagos that you can see them wild. You have to go and see them at the Darwin Research Station. But that may change, because there's successful propagation going on, and there's a population now on Española that may in the future be a tourist destination.
We're almost out of time, but one of the things I wanted to ask you, and you do address this in this book, when I think about the Galapagos now, the other, besides Darwin, the first thing I think about is climate change and how it's going to affect the Galapagos.
Yes.
What's the feeling? Yeah, I have to believe it is.
Well, global warming could change the current patterns, the ocean currents. And the westernmost part of the Galapagos depend on cold water coming in and upwelling. The cold water is deep water from the Pacific upwelling in the Galapagos. That's what sustains the fish population. And that's, of course, what then sustains the giant cormorants, flightless cormorants, and the penguins and all of the seabirds. And the pattern of that could change, will change probably with climate change. So it's not a really optimistic picture that I can paint about that. It is, and the Galapagos, like so much of the rest of the planet, are at risk.
It's on everybody's ecotourist's bucket list to visit the Galapagos. It should be. And as Scott Wiedensahl writes in the introduction, the Galapagos are like no place on Earth. There's nothing on Earth like the Galapagos Islands.
And he's right.
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of another place where you're going to see giant tortoises, penguins, and marine iguanas. And then everything else. It's sort of an overlord. What's the best time of the year to visit?
The best time is from, say, March through November. The depths of winter are not as good because the seasonality isn't the same. You don't get the Gariwa mist in the highlands, which keeps the highlands moist, and the albatrosses, the waved albatross, aren't breeding then. They're out at sea. So the best times, I mean, it's a broad window, but from about late February, March through early November.
I just want to pay one more attention to one more sort of congratulations on the photography. There are some photographs in this book that blow my mind. There's a photograph of a frigate bird with a seahorse. And well, I just took a look at that and went, oh my God, what an amazing photo.
If your listeners don't know Kevin Lachlan, he is the director of Wildside Nature Tours, and he is just an extremely talented, experienced, and I dare say professional photographer, wildlife photographer, who has more than 40,000 images of the Galapagos. And he's just got a real touch for it. And I think the thing I love the most about the book is that you can sit with it in your lap and you can tour the Galapagos.
You absolutely can. We're completely out of time. My returning guest tonight has been John. You got the feeling we could talk for hours. John Kreischer, Professor Emeritus of Biology at Wheaton College, an internationally recognized ecologist, ornithologist, and author. And we've been talking about his new book, God, Is It a Stunner? Galapagos, A Natural History. John, it's a pleasure as always.
Thank you, Margaret. It always is from my end, too.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.